not a religious conclusion, but it's looking at the physical evidence that certainly would be appropriate in a science classroom. Another example would be seen as we walk along the beach and we see the parallel lineations that are left by the waves. Seems to be some kind of organization there, though as we observe it erased and then repeated each day, we conclude, yes, this is done by the waves. This is a natural process. We go a little further down the beach and we see John loves Mary. I think I'm justified in saying I don't think it's very reasonable to think the waves did that. That's not because of blind faith or religious operation. That is what we see as evidence from the physical world, just like the arrowhead. The observation would be that information clearly implies intellect. You don't get John loves Mary. I know that from the waves because they don't have that intellect and can't do that. Again, not a religious conclusion. Instead, this is truly a scientific conclusion based on observing the demonstrable facts. We see arrowheads and hearts with John love Mary all the way through the universe, over and over again. And I think it deserves the same kind of conclusion. We look at this drawing of a fly. This is one from the United Arab Republic. But somebody's drawn ants on the wing, it appears. Now, how did those ant pictures on the wing get there? Well, maybe an ink bottle spilled. I don't think so. That's a little too detailed. You've got the correct antenna, the differentiated head and tail and thorax. Everything is in the right place in order. Somebody drew that way, or it would not look like that. Now, when you see the same thing on a real fly, this is a real fly from the United Arab Republic, and nobody drew that. That's the way it grew. That's the way they all grow. The babies will have the same markings. Now, did that come about as a result of time and chance or as a result of design? If we conclude that that arrowhead was designed, what do you conclude about the ants on the wing? This is the peacock fly, and it's astounding. How did it come to grow that way? It flutters the wings and scares off the predators. Serves a very obvious purpose. Now, we know the purpose of the arrowhead and the purpose of the heart. I think there's purpose involved here as well. And I don't think it happened naturally. And if you understand it's reasonable to conclude the arrowhead didn't happen naturally, what about this? We look at the folded paper, the origami. And if you've ever been involved in that kind of thing, you know you do some head scratching. You don't do it right, you're going to mess up. It's not easy. Indicates somebody's thinking. But then you look at some of the leaves that grow that are folded in a very delicate manner to look like what? Look just like a hummingbird. Amazing design, I'll say. That doesn't happen by waves going back and forth on the beach or rocks tumbling down there. This happens through intellect. Mr. Paley, William Paley, back in the 1800s, developed this argument, I think, in a very effective way in a book called Natural Theology. That was the term that was substituted for faith, or at least our faith was substituted, the word faith. The word for faith in that time was natural theology. I think that's a better description of it. But he argued about finding a watch as you walk down the beach and you see the gears and the I think, obvious intellect that's involved in the process. And he said that naturally, necessarily infers a watchmaker. Now, do you see watches in the biological world? Absolutely. Let me give you an example of one that was written up just recently in Science magazine, referring to cyanobacteria. They undergo daily cycles each day. At every time each day, they do certain things. Well, how do they know what time it is? How do they keep up with that cycle process? The biochemical machinery, a ratcheting mechanism by which the oscillator ticks unidirectionally. It ticks just like a clock with a ratchet, with cogs and gears, which are produced by waves hitting the beach or wind blowing. Cogs and gears that rotate unidirectionally with a ratchet. These cogs and gears, it says, is a system that reveals the molecular mechanism of biological timekeeping. This is how they keep time. They've got a clock. Now you see the watch on the beach, you see the watch in the leaf, the cyanobacteria. Why do you blindly close your eyes in one direction and open them in the other? Paley saw it on the beach. We see it in the cyanobacteria. And there are a number of things in nature that have cogs and gears. Here's from Live Science 2013, creature with interlocking gears. Now, if you were trying to manufacture that, you'd have to know what you're doing to make that work. Gears are ubiquitous in man-made world, found in items ranging from wristwatches, the car engines. A species of plant-hopping insect known to the process has functional gears. These are pictures of the gears of the plant hopper. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about creation science. It is the scientific data. I think one of the most dramatic examples would be when you look at these tiny, teeny, tiny bacteria, and the tail is driven by an outboard motor whirling around and propels itself like a motorboat. You think, well, that's stretching it a little bit. Well, let's just look at the descriptions that we see in Science. This is machinery that is designed. In Science 2017, it talks about the bacterial flagellum. That's the tail on the end. The bacterial flagellum is a rotary nanomotor that allows bacteria to propel themselves through liquids, a machine that self-assembles. A machine is pretty impressive, but it self-assembles. Now, that's what we're talking about with scientific data, but this one has a rotor, it has a stator, O-rings, it has bushings, U-joint, drive shaft, just like electrical motors. And if you're missing the U-joint, you're just out of business. It doesn't work. If you're missing the rotor, it's not going to work. This works beautifully, turning at 100,000 revolutions per minute. Now, your car drives down the highway at 2,000, 3,000 revolutions per minute. You get up to 8 and it's really working hard. And you get up to 10, you're probably going to have parts going in all directions. This is 100,000 revolutions per minute. It does have a network control clutch and brakes. It has over 30 functioning coordinated parts, so that this part is essential. If it's missing any of the 30 parts, it's not going to work. All of them have to be there at one time. That's not going to be produced by an evolutionary process gradually going up one at a time. Darwin admitted the implications of that when he said in the book Origin of the Species, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Well, there it is. That says break down according to Darwin himself, because they're all essential and they're working so beautifully, better than the car in your automobile or the electric cars that they're producing, not at 100,000 revolutions per minute. Now, observation is what science is about, and it demonstrates that machines are designed. Would that be a fair assumption? If you see machines, our observation says every time you've got a machine, somebody designed it. Therefore, design is the scientific explanation, because that's what we've got here. Now, here's a machine that is beautifully designed, better than we can design electric motors. By the way, turning at 100,000 revolutions per minute, it can reverse itself in a quarter turn. Amazing motor. But how many engines like that, how many motors like that do we find in the universe? Well, maybe we get an indication from this report recently, 2018, about yeast. Now, this is about as simple an organism as we can find. It blows up and produces gas, but it's a very, very simple organism. If Darwin looked at it, he'd think, well, maybe you've got 10 or 15 parts, maybe 100 parts. Probably didn't think there was that many. How many parts do you think you have to this simplest organism that we can imagine? Maybe a few hundred. This article says it has been subjected to the most comprehensive analysis and measurement of the absolute molecules per cell. How many molecules per cell? It's about like the size of a bacteria. 210 trillion molecules in one of the yeast cells. Now, they're not just piled into the cell, into the membrane. They form 42 million proteins. You heard a little bit about proteins Sunday, and I had the opportunity, the pleasure of listening to an excellent presentation on that subject. And if you know something about it, what you know is that proteins are machines, and they are functioning together, 42 million of them, as one in one cell. The text says, and this is a peer-reviewed, certainly secular journal, like the machines invented by humans, these proteins contain highly coordinated moving parts. Now, you got that bacterial flagellum, that's pretty impressive. You multiply that by 42 million and put it all in one cell, and it functions as one. And that was all accomplished by the waves coming up on the beach or the wind blowing, you think? Describing it further in cell systems, it's spinning to and fro, turning about various axes at a million rotations, not per minute, per second. 100,000 blew our minds, but a million per second? That's what's going on with 42 million machines all functioning together as one. What does that look like to you? Just happened all by itself, you think? Somebody's got their eyes closed. Let's compare this to what we found fairly recently at a site of ancient Tyre. Maybe some of you remember the ancient story, the Greeks in the Battle of Tyre, and it fell with a very deceitful strategy. We won't go into the history of it. It would help if you knew that, but they found it this archaeological dig, an inscription that was a recipe for what was called oracle soup. Now, Oracle of Delphi, not too far from there, across the Aegean Sea, here was a woman, she's supposed to be able to tell the future, and everybody came to hear her proclamations from the divine source. Here is an oracle that came from soup, and they're supposed to look at the soup, and they did intros of organs and all kinds of devices to tell the future, but soup evidently was one. Here was a recipe, and so they decided to cook some up to see what they would find, and they cooked it and cooked it and pulled the lid off. Well, it looks kind of like tomato soup, but it's not saying much. So let's cook it some more. So we cook it a little bit longer, and after a long time, finally, it says, "Watch out for large wooden horses." You buy that story? I don't think so. And why don't you buy that story? Well, you've got intellect involved here. You've got a message, and that's not going to happen by boiling soup any more than John loves Mary on the beach. But we're told that you just boil this prebiotic soup long enough, you get the kind of proteins, the organized machines that we've been talking about, all by themselves naturally. That prebiotic soup is supposed to just happen by itself. And this is a picture out of one of the textbooks. With amino acids, as lightning or some kind of mechanism jarring it along, it turns into what we see in the world today. Now, I think that's nonsense. I don't think you're going to buy "watch out for wooden horses" as something that just happened. But the complexity of that yeast cell makes that look ridiculously simple. Well, what do they say about that? How do they explain it? There's much, much more information than "watch out for wooden horses" in the living things that we see in the world today. Michael Ruse is probably the leading philosopher of science in our country today, debating these issues and speaking. I've heard him speak on a number of occasions, had a number of conversations with him, a philosopher at Florida State University. He was being interviewed by Ben Stein and asked how he explains this origin of life and all of the complexity. And maybe you'd like to hear how he explained it.
How do we get from inorganic world to the world itself?
Well, one popular theory is that it might have started off on the backs of crystals. Molecules piggybacked on the back of crystals forming, and that this led to more and more complex. But of course, the nice thing about crystals is every now and then you get mistakes, mutations, and that this opens the way for natural selection.
But at one point there was not a living thing.
Yeah.
And then there was a living thing. How did that happen?
Well, this is I've just told you. And I don't see any reason why you shouldn't go from very simple to more and more complex to more and more complex.
I don't either, but I don't know how you get from mud to a living cell. That's my question.
Yes, well, I've told you.
I think it was on a diamond. On the backs of crystals.
On the backs of crystals is at least one hypothesis, yes.
So that's your theory, and you think that is more likely and less far-fetched than intelligent design?
I think it is.
Well, that's the best that can be done. I don't think that's very persuasive, especially when he's talking about natural selection working on dead things. You got to be alive to select something and to then be superior to be passed on, but he's talking about molecules that are not alive, along with other serious problems. The shape of crystals is determined by the actual molecule of the mineral itself, and it's a stacking phenomenon. DNA is not like that at all. There's no real similarity in any way. But he just blindly refuses to look at the clear implications. Let me illustrate that blindness this way with a scientist here who's working over in East Africa, and he sees some of the evidence of ancient man, he thinks, and here's a rock that has a chip in the side of it. Okay, looks like it's been worked. Could be. Maybe a man chipped this so that he could then use it to, as an implement, a tool. And so it's shaped. He concludes that's a prehistoric tool, therefore it was intelligently designed. Now he's illustrating the process that we're talking about. He's looking not at a religious document, but at the actual physical evidence, and concludes it's intelligently designed. But he is very prejudiced in the way he looks, because this same scientist will look at the yeast cell with 42 million functional proteins, machines, and says, nope, that's not intelligently designed at all. Now, does that make any sense to you? Somebody's got their eyes closed, blindly refusing to see the evidence. We can see that expressed rather plainly sometimes. Richard Dawkins, one of the leaders in the thinking of the evolutionist, says in his book, Blind Watchmaker, from that book you can tell where his faith is, biology is the study of complicated things that give the appearance of having been designed for a purpose. And my response is, well, maybe it's what it looks like. But he says, yes, this is what it looks like. And he continues on page 36. Animals give the appearance of having been designed by a theoretically sophisticated, practically ingenious physicist or engineer. Yeah, he's got that right. And maybe that's what it looks like. Maybe that's it. No, he absolutely refuses that, as does Francis Crick, the Nobel laureate, devout atheist. He says, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. Yeah, it looks that way, but you just have to remind yourself, continue, don't look that direction. That's not allowed. In other words, keep your blinders on. You're not allowed to look in all directions. I don't think that's good science. But that's what we have in the classrooms today. Intelligent design is not allowed in the classroom. As I put it, there's no intelligence allowed there as far as origins are concerned. I think that's a problem. Certainly, both creation and evolution, I believe we can demonstrate, can be investigated scientifically. We look at the physical evidence and we can discern with the arrowhead, with the heart with air through it, and John loves me, that this is intelligent design. Both of them can be examined from the physical evidence, and when we look at the physical evidence, we see clear indication of design. And you consider alternative views. Maybe you can have a living functional cell arriving on the back of a crystal, but I don't think anybody's ever seen that. Anybody here? I've seen flies and I've seen John Loves Mary, but I haven't seen a molecule arriving on the back of a crystal. But we examine that, and when we do, we see which one is the better explanation. But we're told creation and evolution are not equal because evolution is scientific and creation is religious, and never the twain shall be compared. Well, I think both of them have very profound religious implications, and it's ridiculous to deny that evolution does, which, of course, they do. Both of them. Let me give you an example from Richard Dawkins himself. And in his interview, he tells you the implications, the religious implications of evolution.
Made a decision that you didn't believe in God, or?
Yes, I suppose I switched from Christian theism to some sort of deism around about the age of 14 or 15, and then switched to atheism around about the age of 16.
And was there a particular point that, or something that you read, or an experience you had that sort of said, yeah, this is it? God doesn't exist.
Oh, well, by far the most important, I suppose, was understanding evolution. I think the evangelical Christians have really sort of got it right in a way in seeing evolution as the enemy, whereas the more, what shall we say, sophisticated theologians who are quite happy to live with evolution, I think they're deluded. I think the evangelicals have got it right in that there really is a deep incompatibility between evolution and Christianity, and I think I realized that at the age of about 16.
We've got a lot of 16-year-olds reaching that same conclusion. They're only having one side of the issue. I think we need both. But to give you a further indication of the faith nature of these conclusions, Isaac Asimov, one of the more famous atheists in our country, recently deceased, says, "I have faith and believe myself. I believe nothing beyond those natural laws is needed. It's simply what I have faith in, what I believe." Now, it's not because he's convinced by the evidence. He admits that. He wants to be an atheist. And in other instances, the implications regarding the way he lives his life is a motivating factor. But he believes, without evidence, in a lack of design, in spite of the evidence. I think it's absolutely amazing what an unbeliever has to believe in order to be an unbeliever. The unbeliever believes that there was nothing, and then nothing happened to nothing until nothing exploded for no reason, creating everything. And a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself into self-replicating bits, which turned into dinosaurs and eventually into people. Now, that takes a lot of faith. They believe nothing created everything. And you got books, number one sellers on the New York Times bestseller list. Nothing created everything. Big explosion produced the ordered universe. We had one of our teachers trying to get this point across to her junior high class. She got a great big styrofoam cup full of confetti and put a huge, I think, M80 firecracker down in the bottom of that with a fuse sticking out the bottom. Didn't tell the teachers on either side of the classroom, but lit that thing, boom, while the confetti went everywhere. And I think the kids got the idea. It didn't produce any organization. The idea the teachers on either side got was not exactly what she had anticipated, but the kids remembered that. Does not produce organization. Molecules self-assemble, become living cells. Errors in information produce more information. Don't tell me it's not religious. They don't believe. They're really good at blind faith. And I don't think that's very honest, is a simple way to put it. Blind faith is not commendable. But it has very profound implications. Well, this is just science. Let's just think about the implications as expressed by Jerry Rifkin, author of The Green New Deal, some of you may have heard of. We won't get into politics, but here is a book he co-authored called Evolutionary Ethics. Now, it affects ethics. That's what the book is about. And notice the quotes that we've chosen that would certainly give you an idea to understand the kind of ethics it produces. We no longer feel ourselves to be guests in someone else's home and therefore obliged to make our behavior conform with a set of pre-existing cosmic rules. It is our creation now, and we make the rules. Imagine what kind of world that produces. We no longer have to justify our behavior, for we are now the architects of the universe. We are responsible to nothing outside ourselves, for we are the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. That comes from evolutionary ethics, and you can imagine where it leads. Don't tell me one is religious and the other is scientific. That's extremely naive. That's not so. Both can be investigated scientifically, and both have profound religious implications. But in spite of the intimidating propaganda in this world, we are gaining ground dramatically. The truth is winning. A recent poll conducted by Gallup indicated 40% of the people in this country believe God created humans in their present form, whereas 33% said God did it by evolution. Only 22% believe in naturalistic evolution, which is what's taught as propaganda in the classroom today. Nothing else allowed. 22% believe it. I don't think that's the American way, but that's what's dominating because we allow it. Think about that. Another poll is, I think, very revealing, done in 2016, nationwide, testing two propositions. Teachers and students should have the academic freedom to objectively discuss both the scientific strengths and weaknesses of the theory of evolution. That sound reasonable? 93% of the country agrees with that. It's important for policymakers and public to hear scientists with different views. 94% believe that. But it's not happening. It's not allowed. Scientists are intimidated. If it weren't for the vicious intimidation, I think we could win this battle overnight. But in spite of that intimidating force, your career is over. Somebody says the C word, creation, regarding your career. Nevertheless, a number have courageously stepped out. Here's an article from back in 2001, and this has stimulated a great deal of interest since then. The poll has grown. But it tested the proposition, we are skeptical of the claims for the ability of random mutation, natural selection to account for the complexity of life. We're skeptical of Darwinism. And 100 scientists signed it then. Now then, there are over 1,000 scientists who have become signatories to that statement, all with doctorates in the natural sciences, including scientists from the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, Russian, Polish, Czech National Academies, from such universities as Yale and Princeton and Harvard and MIT and Columbia, Purdue, Berkeley, UCLA, Duke, Cambridge, Oxford, including University of Missouri and Washington University. Many scientists, thousands of scientists across the country, have seen the points that you're seeing tonight and said, that makes sense. Brian Josephson would be one. He's a Nobel Prize winner, professor in physics from Cambridge. Writing in 2021, less than a year ago, he's talking about the book The Return of the God Hypothesis, which makes a very powerful case for intelligent design by Stephen Meyer. He says, this book makes it clear that far from being an unscientific claim, intelligent design is valid science. Now, he's no ignoramus, Nobel Prize winner, professor of physics from Cambridge. But in spite of that and the thousands of others that have joined, you have statements like this from Ernst Mayr of Harvard. No educated person any longer questions the validity of the so-called theory of evolution, which we now know to be a simple fact. That's just a simple lie. I know he knows better. But this is the propaganda, and it influences a lot of people's thinking. He doesn't want you to evaluate the evidence, look at both sides of it. He wants you to just be intimidated. And intimidation is the most powerful force that they have. Let me give you an example of the methodology that is promoted by Richard Dawkins of Oxford. He says, go beyond humorous ridicule. Sharpen our barbs to a point where they really hurt. I think they're likely to be swayed by looking at both sides of the evidence. No. By a display of naked contempt. Nobody likes to be laughed at. Nobody wants to be the butt of contempt. That sounds very scientific. But that's what prevails in the scientific world on this issue. Professor P.Z. Myers, University of Minnesota, is one of the leading proponents of this methodology. talking about intelligent design, he says they're theocrats, faith healers, snake oil artists. Call them a bunch of names. That'll win the day. I say, blankety blank, the polite words and careful rhetoric. It's time for scientists to break out the steel-toed boots, brass knuckles, and get out there and hammer the lunatics and idiots. Now, this is what we're paying tax dollars to teach our kids to. He continues, here's an example of the bad guys, Don Patton, referring to a presentation where he was present. I spoke before the textbook committee in Austin, textbook committee of choosing the textbooks there. He was preeming smarmily. I didn't know I knew how to do that. Accusing Darwinism of failing because a prediction had failed. Darwin predicted the gaps would be filled in, and they weren't. He can quote biologists from Darwin to Eldridge saying that such a complete series has not been found. Well, yeah, that part he got right. This is the way they seek to intimidate. Eugenia Scott, who was president of the National Center for Science Education, writing under the heading Fighting Words in New Scientist, how to fight. Well, scientists should refuse formal debates because they do more harm than good. And she learned that firsthand. The last debate that I had scheduled was at LSU in the main geology building with the head of the Department of Geology there at LSU, Baton Rouge. Been scheduled for 6 months. We got there and the place was full. Well over 400 in an auditorium that seated 300. And the professor didn't show. So I won. We spoke for an hour and Q&A for another hour. And some of them stayed till midnight. It was interesting. The campus crusaders were the ones that put on the debate. They handed out cards, made them fill out the cards as they came in. And 53% believed in creation who came. And that's a disproportionate amount to the population, but they were more interested in the evidence. They followed up 2 weeks later. 78% then believed in creation. Which would teach him not to show up. They have stopped. And this is the reason. They know better. Evidently. Darwin's view was very different, expressed in Origin of the Species. He says a fair result can only be obtained by fully stating and balancing the facts and arguments on both sides of each question. I find myself with Darwin at this point, but they will not and do not, and coach others not to. But let's just look at the facts quickly, and we don't have time to go through most of it, but you have to begin with defining terms. Evolution is just change, one of the professors told me. I said, well, I think evolution might be change. You can define, but you know, I believe in change. I've got some in my pocket, but I think we need to define our terms better if we're going to have a good conversation. What might be called the special theory or horizontal variation can be seen as we look in the world, but we see barriers to that. Dogs become dogs with a great deal of variation. But that's not the issue. The issue is that general theory of evolution, which says things began simply and then gradually progressed upward to more complexity, a change from one kind to another kind, which is very different from what we observe today. This is the issue and what they don't want to talk about. Horizontal variation within the kind, as opposed to change from one kind to another kind, are two very different issues, and they don't want to talk about one. 90% of the conversation is about the one that's not an issue. Now, how do we determine where the scientific evidence lies? Well, we use the scientific method, which, by the way, was initiated, at least give credit given to Francis Bacon, who was a devout creationist. And Basically, it's a way to be honest and fair with the evidence. You go with, number one, what's observable, not what you imagine. What's repeatable, you do it, then somebody else performs the experiment, repeats it. And it has to be experimental, demonstrable, and falsifiable, a concept that probably is unfamiliar to most, but basically means testable. You have to be able to put up a circumstance so that if this happens, it's verified. If this happens, it's falsified. And if it's not potentially falsifiable, you can't test it. It's not really science. That may be the most important criteria. Well, looking at those four rules of definition of the scientific method, which, by the way, is simply a definition in the textbook. It seldom governs conduct. But is evolution observable? Well, in the living world, we do not see that. We see variation. G. Leonard Stebbins of Harvard says the reason the major steps have never been observed is that they require millions of years. Okay, if they require millions of years, you're not going to observe them, but then just bottom line is you don't see it, and that's the first criteria of the scientific method. But you should be able to see in the fossil record that's supposed to record what happens over millions of years. Stephen Gould speaks about that, and we'll talk more about it later this week. He says the extreme rarity of transitional forms in the fossil record persists as the trade secret of paleontology. We never see the very process we profess to study. So you don't see it in the living world. You don't see it in the fossil record. It went so fast you didn't see it, is what Gould says. Well, what about being experimental? Jerry Cohn, vicious anti-creationist, University of Chicago, says evolutionary biology is a historical science. Unlike harder scientists, we usually cannot resolve issues with a simple experiment. Things that happen in history, did this happen? Did it happen this way? You don't resolve that with an experiment, do you? And we're dealing with historical processes, so it's not subject to experimentation. Colin Patterson, recently deceased, was president of our curator, the British Museum of Natural History, the largest fossil museum in the world. And he's talking about the change from ape man, Australopithecus, to man. It's unique and unrepeatable. Well, that's the way history is. Like the history of England. Unique events are by definition not a part of science, for they are unrepeatable, not subject to test. Not a part of science may not be, not a part of absolute scientific proof, yes. For scientific proof, you follow the four rules of the scientific method. That doesn't work with evolution. It also doesn't work with creation. You can't see and repeat and test. So neither are provable in that strict scientific sense, following the scientific method. That which is observable and repeatable and experimental and falsifiable applies actually, technically, to neither. Neither are subject to scientific proof, but both of them can be investigated scientifically. The method that is used for those things that we don't observe directly would be model comparison. We don't know what's happening in the interior of the sun, but we come up with what we can observe, and we have models, and we see which model works best. In the world around us, we see facts from biology and microbiology and physics, geology, paleontology, and those facts that we can see fit sometimes, don't fit better here. Not. As we compare the two models, we see which one fits the facts best. This is the principle of model comparison, sometimes referred to as Occam's razor or the principle of parsimony. And that's the way we proceed when we're looking at creation evolution scientifically. Which model is better? And we'll just begin and have to suffice mostly with just looking at what Darwin saw and explaining what he saw and see which one explains better. He traveled around the world as the ship's naturalist on the Beagle and saw animals he had not seen in England, and began to imagine and devise models to describe how that came to be. He saw birds and turtles and all kinds of things that were just intrigued him. Collected a number of finches, took them back to England, thought about them. It was 2 years later before he came up with his idea that this really was a good illustration and proof of evolution. The finches that had the big beaks were on the islands that didn't have the big trees. They had to make a living eating seeds on the ground. But those with smaller beaks could poke into the bark and get insects. And so they differentiated where they lived by whether or not they could eat better, one or the other. But what he saw was evidence for horizontal variation. A finch with a slightly bigger beak or a slightly smaller or pointier beak, but certainly a finch. I think he exaggerated the implications, as we've learned since. But he saw evidence for horizontal variation. He saw no evidence for the finch changing into something besides a finch from this single origin, from a simple organism developing into everything else. But that's not the way it's reported. In fact, just fairly recently here, 2006, headlines, Darwin's finches evolved before scientists' eyes. Okay, let's see what we've got here. Scientists for the first time observed in real time evolutionary changes in species driven by competition for resources. All right, that's what Darwin talked about. Now they have seen it with these finches. But then we look at the rest of the story, and they tell us the shrinkage of beaks during the drought. And they could see during the drought a percentage of difference in the smaller beaks. It was about 1 millimeter. They're a very small change. Actually, there was no shrinkage. The small ones existed before. They're just more of the ones with smaller beaks than the ones were larger, so there was really no change. And then the only real difference they acknowledged was the relative numbers. But look at the headlines. Here's finches evolved before scientists' eyes. Well, a change in the relative numbers of bigger and smaller beaks. Now, that's not quite what the headlines are saying. And then as we read further here in Nature, 2014, they follow up saying Darwin's tree finches have collapsed under the conditions of hybridization into two. They had 14 in Darwin's day, and what they were writing about before was 14, because that's what Darwin said. Now then, they have gone backwards. This horizontal variation goes one way with the drought and one way when there's no drought, back and forth. Now then, they're just two instead of 14 as in the textbook. So it's a reversible picture of horizontal variation, not the way it's presented in the textbooks, but the propaganda that we see continues to say, and here in 2018, Darwin's finches prove a mechanism for rapid formation of new species. Little bit bigger, well, not really bigger at all, but the ones with bigger beaks, a few more of them, they survive better under certain conditions. Let's think about what Darwin did not see. He didn't see a cowbird or a bird dog. And we look at that and we laugh, and we laugh because, no, we know that maybe a few more of the ones with bigger beaks and a few more. Yeah, that's not funny. We see that. But what we don't see is the kind of thing that would indicate, yeah, we're going to have a change here. He saw a variety of finches. He saw horizontal variation, which is not the issue at all, which nobody that I know of disagrees with. Another quick argument that we'll look at that's in all of the textbooks, like the finches, would be the pepper moths. Before the Industrial Revolution, the trees were light-colored. The light-colored moths were camouflaged, black ones showed up, and the theory was black ones are going to get it a lot more often than those that are camouflaged. But then after the Industrial Revolution and the soot covered the trees, the black ones were camouflaged, and so the relative numbers would change. Black ones and dark light ones before, and likewise after, but now then the relative numbers change. Interesting to notice Matthew's conclusion. He, probably the most famous biologist in England, was asked to write the foreword to the centennial edition of Origin of the Species, a very great honor, honoring Darwin. He says, the peppered moths, Bistin Bachelera, do not show evolution in progress. For however the population may alter, all the moths remain from beginning to end, Bistin Bachelera. Still the same species, light and dark before, light and dark after. And he was the one they chose to write the centennial edition forward. But still, this is what's promoted here in the National Wildlife Encyclopedia, the most striking evolutionary change ever witnessed by man. I think they're right. That's the best they can do. That's it. Certainly not general evolution. And even that argument has been discredited. It's in all the textbooks, but Jerry Cohn, a very strong anti-creationist, acknowledged that Majerus, who reproduced the experiment that Darwin did, said the most serious problem was that Bistin Bachelera probably doesn't rest on tree trunks. I've seen thousands of them on tree trunks in the textbooks. They were glued on, pinned on. Exactly two moths have been seen in such a position in 40 years of intensive research. Now, that's not science. And even the anti-creationists are embarrassed by it. But still, here, 2011, peppered moth, Bistin Bachelera, one of the most widely recognized examples of contemporary evolutionary change in science, our most scientific journal in the U.S. 2020, American biology teacher, here they are on the front page. This is science. Now, why wouldn't they want alternative views? Why wouldn't they want somebody to write a response? Can you imagine? No, I know exactly why they don't want answers to that. The kids would make fun of them. Lots of ways to test the idea that this change adds up. We don't have time to go into all of it, but we'll look at this obvious example from National Geographic. You go back to amber, 100 million years old, we're told, and now then we see critters like encased in the amber still alive today. Okay, what happened? Let's see what progressed in 100 million years. Trapped in tiny drops of ancient amber, 245 million to 208 million years old, which I don't buy, but we'll play the game their way and see how it comes out. Surprisingly, these microscopic organisms look familiar to today's scientists. They've undergone few or no physical changes. And you just multiply examples like that. We'll summarize the picture as it is seen today with Eugene Koonin. He's maybe the most representative and respected biologist in our country. He's with the National Center for Biotechnology, senior investigator. Everybody listens when he speaks. And he has written a scathing review of Darwinism, saying that the traditional concept of the tree of life, front page of Darwin's book, the way he starts, the only illustration in his book, this tree of life, and natural selection, the main driving force of evolution, he says that's gone. All of that is not defensible scientifically. And he's not a creationist. He's an atheist, but he says this is evidence that won't stand. He says the modern synthesis, which is the description of Darwinism, as it's taught today, has crumbled, apparently beyond repair. Not to mince words, the modern synthesis is gone. Still in the textbooks, but scientifically, it is not there. The bedrock of textbook evolution would be the survival of the fittest. That's what you think of when you think of Darwinism. This appeared, notice the date, May 2021. This is not out of date. This is written by the editor of Science. That's the most authoritative journal in our country, the official journal of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. The editor of the journal wrote in the editorial, "The survival of the fittest does not accurately represent the dynamics of evolutionary process." He's right. I mean, it should have been written a long time ago. First, real problem is that the survival of the fittest is not the issue anyway. It's the arrival of the fittest that is the problem. Once you get several that are fit, you can choose, but how do you get to the ones, the new organisms that are more fit, does not deal with that. And it is actually a tautology. How do you define the fittest? Well, it's those that survive. Okay, therefore those that survive are the fittest. And so guess what? The fittest survive. What are you saying here? It's not saying anything. It's a tautology. It's a heads I win, tails you lose proposition. And that's not scientific. And maybe if I allow my daughter to sing that to you, it might fit in.
Down the fit will be survivors, and survivors will be fit, and survivors will survive to prove the fitness of the fit. Oh, this natural selection, it's so simple, isn't it? 'Tis ruthless marching on.
Generous enough to give my daughter all of my music ability, and that's her contribution. Creation science involves evaluating the models. Here's the evidence on one side, the evidence on the other side. We see engines, machinery, 42 million machines on the one hand. I think intelligence can explain that. I don't think anything else can. It can't explain John loves Mary without intelligence, certainly not 42 million coordinated machines. On the other hand, information, like even John loves Mary, is unexplainable by natural sources. And the explanations that have been put in the textbooks are gone, according to the leading authorities. Now, which model is best? That's creation science. Now, that's not the way it's taught. Here in the Natural History Museum, creationists seek to impose on the population at large by political means a body of religious beliefs derived from a literal reading of the King James Version of the Bible, both Old and New Testament. This is the truth. It's about scientific facts, evidence that we can see in the world around us. Is that best explained by intelligent design or by just happenstance? And if you allow both sides to be presented, I think the battle would be over tomorrow. There is tremendous evidence here, and we hope that that's obvious. I think our time is up. We'll conclude at that point.